many times have you heard a radio host say, "I wish our listeners could have heard the conversation I had with our guest during the break"? I've heard it and said it many times over the years. That is where this podcast was born. We'll go in deeper with our guests to find out more about them and learn life lessons from some influential people. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and share, as well as rate and review the podcast on iTunes. I'm Clint Powell. This is During the Break. Let's do it. Hi, welcome to During the Break. It's Clint Powell. Thanks for finding the podcast. Be sure to listen, download, share, review, all those things that selfishly help the podcast grow. And thank you to everybody that has already done that. We've got like 15 reviews, hundreds and hundreds of shares and listens and downloads. So I appreciate it. Today's episode is brought to you by a good friend of mine. If you are from Chattanooga or the North Georgia area, you have heard of this company, JB Millworks. My buddy Jeremy Price, they do trim work. They do doors. They do windows. They can help you with stair parts. Anything that goes inside your house to make your house look better. So if you're building a house, that's awesome. If you're remodeling a house, that's awesome. Call Jeremy and his folks at JB Millworks, 706-965-6940, 706-965-6940. You can also find them on Google, just JB Millworks. Tell them I sent you, tell them that you were listening to the podcast. They have helped a bunch of my friends, and I know they can help you make your world better to live in. With that being said, every week I have at least two podcast downloads. Sometimes I have three. This week we had our Tuesday podcast. That's usually my shorter version. The Fridays are longer. They're conversation with guests. I call some of them friends. So far, all of them have been friends, and that offends them a little bit. Rich Mazingo from the Chattanooga Lookouts got a little offended. I called him a friend. We're going to try it with today's guest. We'll see if he actually claims it or not. A friend of mine, a well-known, nationally well-known attorney, Eric Buchanan. How are you doing, friend?
Good, Clint. Yeah, you can call me friend. And if you want me to, we could start off by telling stories about how we first met and all that stuff going back. How long ago?
It's been close to 20 years. Yeah. I want you to tell your bio, because it's a diverse, you know, background. Most people are surprised when they find out all the stuff you've done. But we did meet playing rugby. Chattanooga rugby team.
That was a lot of fun. That was a good time back then.
Great fun. Are you kidding me?
I would still be doing it if my body would be good maybe within 3 days afterwards, but now I hurt the whole week if I try to do that anymore, and that's, yeah.
I watch it sometimes, and of course, at a certain level, you know, none of us played at that level. We had a couple guys that played at higher levels than we did, but none of us really played at the level that we watch on TV. But even when I watch the impact, the impacts are all relative. That's all the same. I look at that sometimes and go, did I do that? Because I think about doing that now, and I think, well, my shoulder would be gone and my hip.
We'd be hurting for a long time. God. You know what's going on, though, is the Chattanooga rugby team right now is doing really, really well. If you haven't kept up with them.
I have a little bit. Yeah, I've been to see a couple games.
Yeah, they've gone up a level in the division since we played, and they're playing big cities and doing well.
All we really like to do is hit. We did like to hit, though. Yeah, we had a good hitting
team. Now they have plays.
Oh, do they? We had plays. They have crash. Crash left, crash right. Pass the ball.
And do good to actually turn around and present the ball. That means you'd been to practice before.
Absolutely. Present the ball. What does that even mean? I remember the first game I played. If you've played rugby, then you'll know, you know, there's a transition, especially if your background is football. Because rugby's basically everything opposite. I mean, I delivered a really big hit and I ran out. I got knocked out of bounds, but I clubbed the guy. And I turn around and all you guys are looking at me like, we just lost possession of the ball, man. I'm like, but I hit him really hard. That's not the name of the game. I know it looks like that on TV. It's not kill the man with the ball. There's a purpose in what we do. All right, before we go too far down the rugby rabbit hole, tell everybody what kind of law you practice, how long you've been doing it, and give them a little bit about your education.
I help disabled people fight insurance companies. That's the biggest part of what I do. I help people with other similar employee benefits. A long-term disability insurance is something that a lot of employers offer. And if somebody becomes disabled and can't work anymore, unfortunately, there's way too many times that those insurance companies decide not to pay those benefits.
Okay.
Similar to that, sometimes people have life insurance through work, and for one reason or another, the insurance company decides not to pay those benefits. So I help with those kind of claims. Sometimes people buy their own disability insurance policy, and for whatever reason, the insurance companies decide not to pay. Unfortunately, that's getting more and more common.
Is it?
There's some big insurance companies in the United States that have decided the way they're going to make a living is by paying fewer claims, that they are increasing their profits, not just by how they invest their money, not just by how they manage a lot of money and all those premiums and spread out the risk, but by taking it one step further and actually trying to pay fewer claims. And that's becoming more and more rampant in the industry, and unfortunately more and more people having to come hire us to fight for their disability benefits. One of the parts that it's important to understand is I help people whether they bought a private policy on their own or they got it through work, and the ones that they get through work fall under a federal law called ERISA. And I don't want to do a whole podcast on ERISA benefits, but the highlight is if you get your insurance through work, it's not treated like an insurance policy. It's not a contract. It's an employee benefit plan. It falls under federal rules, federal law, and those cases have their own sets of rules. Some ways that can be tougher. Some good rules are on the side of the employee, but if you don't know how ERISA cases work, you shouldn't be handling ERISA cases, and there's not that many attorneys that handle ERISA benefits.
How many
cases
in the state of Tennessee?
Some attorneys have handled a few around the state. There's a couple firms that primarily handle this work in Nashville, and those are both attorneys that are by themselves, one attorney in an office,
right,
a solo practice. My firm, we have five attorneys and a sixth attorney. Hopefully she'll be an attorney. She's taking the bar in about 3 weeks, but she starts work in the middle of August. And assuming she passes the bar, knock on wood, she'll be our sixth attorney. And we've been representing people all over the United States for a while now. One of my favorite referral sources is an attorney named Richard Priest, who's in Maui. And he sent me five or six cases from Maui over the years. Looked at one the other day from him.
You have to visit quite a bit to Maui.
I actually did get to go out in January and have lunch.
That's
why
you're successful.
Him.
I would always be, I got to go to Maui. I just got to go.
There's a conference out there anyway. And while I was at the conference, he and I went out with their wives to dinner and caught up a little bit. But I was just in Pittsburgh week before last, had a client up there. I've got clients all over the United States.
Well, before I ask you about your education and your background when it comes to, you know, your history and all, we're going to get to know you a little bit better today. But before I do that, I always compare ERISA or even anything in your world. It's written by attorneys for other attorneys to interpret, right? It's written by the insurance companies. It's always in that like five font on the back of a page with deadlines built into it, words that you have to look up, that's, you know, from the Bible with thee and therefore. And a lot of times, I think personally, this is me with not having a law degree, they just kind of assume that you're going to miss the window. They'll deny a bunch of stuff. And if they deny 100, maybe 10 will fight, 3 or 4 will win. But most people just decide not to fight.
That's a great way of explaining it, is that too many people give up and don't fight for it. So let's start kind of at the beginning and talk about, for people who might be listening to this, when would this apply to them?
Right.
If you have your health insurance at work and you work for any regular employer that's not a government entity or a church, then your health insurance at work is going to be covered under ERISA, under this federal law. If you have life insurance at work, and again, unless you work for a government entity or a church, so you work for any other kind of regular average employer, any kind of employer that most of us work for, your health insurance or your life insurance, or for a lot of people, disability insurance, dental insurance, accidental death and dismemberment insurance, all those benefits that you sign up for at work, they fall under ERISA. And ERISA was passed in the 1970s originally to protect pension benefits. And at the last minute when they were passing the law, they added a rule that made it apply to other employee benefits, but they didn't write very many clean rules about how they were going to protect those benefits. Well, 40-something years later, it was passed in 1974, so we're coming up on, next year will be the 45th anniversary. There's been a whole line of Supreme Court cases, a whole bunch of interpretations of ERISA over the years, and a lot of them are, whether they're good or bad for the person who's the employee who has a claim, they're tricky rules. And unfortunately, a lot of them are, in fact, bad for the employee. A lot of the rules favor the insurance company. One quick example, in 1989, the Supreme Court issued a decision interpreting an ERISA plan, a case called Firestone Tire versus Brutsch, for lawyers out there who want to go look it up. And in that case, the question was, if the insurance company denies somebody, do we treat it like a contract and let the judge decide if they were right or wrong? Or do we treat it more like a trust because it's an employee benefit plan, in which case we give the benefit of the doubt to the trustee, which is the insurance company? In other words, instead of treating it like an insurance contract, are we going to give the benefit of the doubt to the insurance company that's paying with their own money? And the Supreme Court said, well, in most cases, you let it go either way and the judge decides the case. But, and this big but kind of took over ERISA, the but was, if the insurance company puts in their plan that they have discretion, then they get treated like a trustee and the court gives them deference, which boils down to the insurance company ends up getting the benefit of the doubt in court. They can be wrong as long as they're reasonable about it and still win
an employee benefits case. And reasonable is up for that's the judgment part. That's where wink, wink, nod, nod. You were reasonable. Well, were we reasonable? Who decides that word?
Well, instead of the federal judge looking at it and going, okay, you've got three doctors that say you're disabled. The insurance company has two doctors, but neither one of those doctors saw you. That would be wrong. I would just go with the three doctors who treated you.
Right.
But that's not what the judge is deciding. The judge has to decide, okay, yes, the insurance company is wrong, but now I'm going to decide, here I'm sitting here as the federal judge, are these two doctors the insurance company hired, is that enough for the insurance company to be reasonable in making
a decision? Wrong, but reasonable.
Wrong, but reasonable, and they have a couple doctors supporting them, even though most of the doctors go the other way. Well, can you say it's unreasonable if at least a couple doctors agree with you? And unfortunately, sometimes that's how those cases come out. Now, sometimes we can show even that's unreasonable, and we do win the cases. I wouldn't be making a living doing this, and all the people working on our team would not be making a living if we couldn't win these cases. But it is a tough road to hoe.
So this the beauty of a podcast to me is I get to find out more about you, because I do want to start and stop. We'll end this whole thing talking about what you do too. I don't want to spend all the time on this, because your history and background and your passions about stuff is where I really, that's the reason I do this show. But sticking with this last thing I'll bring up about the insurance, when you talk about this, it's a little sad. The two things I will say, and I'll let you respond, and then we'll move on. One is, sometimes the disability industry, because it's an industry, from the outside looking in, unless you're in the middle of something, it looks like it could be easily taken advantage of. People living on disability that don't deserve it, people that should deserve it don't get it. And the second thing is, I think it's a shame. I'm a guy that has insurance. I buy a policy. Maybe I'm providing it for my employees, because I know you counsel businesses. But all I know is this. I'm simple-minded. I make widgets. I'm really good at making widgets. I got insurance. I'm covered. And in reality, most people just want to get what they think they got. I'm hurt. Can you help me? And then all of a sudden, they try to save a nickel and a dime, and I'm spending dollars. And it's not fair.
Here's one of these interesting comparisons. What other product in our lives is similar to insurance? When you go buy a TV, you go to Best Buy, or you order one online, or you go to Walmart, or wherever, you go buy a TV, assuming that you've got the money to pay for it, you pay for it, and they either load that TV in your car that day, or they delivered it to your house.
Right.
If you go to the grocery store and you go buy some food, you say, here's my money, give me, you check out, you buy your groceries, you check out. You go buy an air conditioner at Sears, and you take that air conditioner home. What do you buy when you buy an insurance policy?
Promises.
You buy a promise.
That's it.
You buy a promise that they're going to take care of you later on when you have a claim. And you're waiting and hoping you'll never need that insurance. The insurance company's hoping you never need it. But when you
they're making money.
But when you do, what you got, what you purchased was a promise. Now, another way to look at this, and I think this is an important way to add into this, we live in a free society. We live in a society where you have the choice to do your best to take care of yourself and your family. And what is one of those things no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, one of the things people will say is that you should be able to take care of yourself. And if you can take care of yourself, you should take care of yourself.
Right.
And maybe some people in this world are just going to become disabled.
That's part of life.
And if you don't plan ahead that it might happen to you, well, we do have Social Security disability to kind of have a safety net there. But if you're a professional, if you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're a business owner, you're an advertising executive, you're a marketing
expert. You leave
expert,
us out of it, mister.
Yeah, whatever. If you make a decent living, you could do the responsible thing that if something happens to you someday and you become disabled, you're going to have this insurance. It's the same concept as doing the responsible thing of buying life insurance.
It's called living inside your means or living above your means. A lot of people do. I make $5,000 a month. I spend $4,600. I really don't have enough to save. I start making $7,000 a month, so I spend $6,800. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
I say that because I'm guilty of it. But that's what happens. I mean, our grandparents didn't do that. They saved.
Well, but what they did have is that they had the early versions of insurance.
Yeah.
And if you go out and you buy insurance, what you're doing is you're doing the responsible thing. You're going to say, if something happens to me and I pass away, my family is going to be taken care of. If something happens to me and I become disabled, my family is going to be taken care of. And I'm not going to be having to rely on society, on the government, on other people's tax money, on my friends and neighbors, my church or whatever, take care of me, because I'm going to do the responsible thing and I'm going to buy this insurance ahead of time.
Yeah.
And then what happens when something does happen to you, if you find out that what you are is a monthly goal for that insurance company to deny claims, to make more money by meeting their target every month by denying a certain percentage of their claims or a certain dollar value of claims every month as a target
or a goal.
It's
in and out. It's cash. You're a cash flow. You're a cog in the wheel.
And it's no longer a promise.
Yeah.
It's no longer the special promise that insurance companies make. A company that sells you nothing but a promise and it turns out that what they're actually doing is trying to crunch numbers and not pay all the claims that are valid claims.
That's where that size 5 font comes in, I mean.
That's why I have the great job that I have helping people, and my team of four, almost five other attorneys and a lot of staff that makes a great team. That's what we do, is we help the insurance companies actually keep the promises that they made.
It's funny. It's sad, and then we'll move on. But I was talking about health care. It's one of the words I wrote down. Maybe we dive in a little bit later, and I don't care. But if you go to your doctor and say, how much is this x-ray? Doctors don't know. This office staff don't know. Well, we have to file that with your insurance company first, which means, if I'm correct, every insurance company has negotiated different with every doctor practice and with every type of x-ray. And it seems to me that if I knew an x-ray was $75, I could pay it.
I don't think x-rays were ever $75, Clint.
Hello,
I don't think when they first invented x-rays, I think they cost more than $75.
If it's above $75, then to follow with it. But I guess my point of that is, right, the people providing the service can't tell you how much the service cost until they work it out through the paperwork trail with the insurance company. So everybody takes their piece of that service you're needing. So in reality, the one that's benefiting from the service and paying in monthly and negotiating gets left hand. I don't even know what my part of a bill is going to be until somebody sits down with a calculator that I don't know what all the buttons are for.
I would love to come back for a future podcast if you could get somebody who's in the insurance industry to talk about health insurance and how it really works, and let me have a conversation with that person about how these cases get litigated once they get to court.
Yeah.
If the insurance company turns the case down. But without somebody else here to kind of counterbalance here, there's a couple things people don't know. What you just mentioned, every insurance company's made a deal with the doctors.
Yeah.
If you're a doctor and you say, I take Blue Cross or I take Aetna or Anthem or whatever insurance company it is, if your procedure was going to cost $75, do you know how much you actually get paid for that? It's typically about 30% of that.
The
doctor's office.
Yeah,
not just what he makes, then you got lights,
and electricity and staff and insurance.
The check that you would write for that procedure is $75. You go see a doctor in the old days, and you've got a cold, and the doctor checks you out and does an office, writes down office visit, Bill Clint Powell, $75. Well, nowadays, he writes down Bill Clint Powell, $75, and then submits it to the insurance company. Under their terms, they're going to pay him $25.
Yeah, $30, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it is, $20, $25 for that office visit. The reason doctors have made that deal historically is because they're going to get everybody who has Blue Cross or Anthem to sign up to become their patients. Well, now most people have insurance. Not everybody. You know, we can have a separate discussion about how you get everybody insurance. But since so many people have insurance, you go to the doctor's office, and instead of it being the three people that are sick, it's the 25 people that he's scheduled for an appointment that day. You know, he's going to make one third off each one. So guess how much time he's going to spend with you?
One third of the time
he used to, or less. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And there goes your home visits. You know, it's funny. My dad had a home visit from a doctor the other day. The doctor came to the house.
Holy cow.
I know. I pulled in, and my dad said, hey, scoot over in the driveway. I'm like, why? He goes, I've got a doctor coming. I'm like, well, what do you mean? He goes, yeah, he does a home visit.
Holy cow.
My dad started going to the VA about 2 years ago. I've been convincing him to go forever. Me and my sister have been trying. So he's been going to the VA, but it was a doctor through the VA that was going to do some.
That's fantastic.
I was amazed. Again, another one of those services. We provide less, but expect more, all of that. So real quick, the health care that we just went through, you know, we're implementing, you know, we got to pass it before we know what's in it, you know, that whole
what some
fiasco.
People call Obamacare, what other people call the Affordable Health Care Act.
Call it as you will.
Right.
And now you've got people trying to pull back on it. They removed the mandate, and which then to me kind of throws it into chaos even further, which I get. Do you think we should have universal health care? Do you see a benefit for that? Do you see a way to do it through insurance companies and keep it private?
So now we're going to have a political discussion.
Partly, yeah. Well, okay, so let's do this.
I'm a libertarian, Clint. I'll just lay it on the table. I'm a libertarian.
We do not
need to have universal health care. We should not have any mandated universal health care. We should have a system that allows people to go see doctors, and if you can buy the insurance, you have the insurance. If you cannot afford the insurance because of something that happened in your life, work a little harder, go out and get a job. If for some reason you cannot do that, yeah, we can have a safety net. We can have Social Security, disability, Medicare, and Medicaid. But if you provide it universally,
you're done.
There's a great expression. People want the best health care money can buy, and they want it for free.
Right.
Well, when it's free for everybody, let me throw this into the conversation. My wife and I got to go on a great trip earlier this summer. We went to Europe, and I'll tell the story separately later on sometime about my wife's dad who was shot down in World War II and was a POW. We went to visit the POW camp. But one of the great things we saw over there was in Berlin was the DDR Museum.
Okay.
The Democratic Republic of Germany, East Germany Museum.
Yeah.
Would you want to get your health care in East Germany?
Nope.
where everybody gets it for free, but nobody gets anything special, and you don't ever get to keep any of the extra money that you make because you got to pay so much in taxes, or they just flat out regulate your salary nationally. That's what universal health care is.
Decentivize. You're not incentivized to create things. The reason I think the United States has been so prolific and growing as fast as we have is we've incentivized, go be the best version of yourself. And if you stop doing that in the workplace, we don't have the very technology that everybody's loving to take advantage of. We don't have the things that we love. I get that there's issues with it. But here's the thing. I'll tell you, I'm a conservative. But as I've gotten older, the last 5 years, I've really gone more to the libertarian side on a lot of issues because of the fact I see that we've become so tribal in our politics. We've become, it's all politics. It's identity politics. It's us against them. And I said this quote to Dawson Wheeler the other day on the podcast. They're a left wing. I'm a right wing. And we forget they're all part of the same bird, man. They all have the big money. Politicians do things now to get votes and not change. Just the way it works. And I hate your guy, so I got to spend all my time talking about how much your guy sucks and then show you how much my person doesn't. Then I get to play the tennis match of moral superiority. And it's unbelievably unproductive. So when I start talking to people like you about healthcare, and all I hear is the word, it's not fair, and it's, look at all these other countries. And then I talked to a guy from, this was 5 years, 6 years ago, who's out of Atlanta, does marketing for a dentist up here. His mother still lives in Canada. He goes, guess what I do? I take her to New York to get healthcare because she's on a waiting list for the stuff that she has in Canada. He goes, for the everyday things, it's fine. But when you really have issues, you do not want to be in that world. That's what we seem to want.
I love the even more simple explanations. I live in Chattanooga downtown. We live in a neighborhood that's pretty safe, but yeah, we're close to some other places where people might wander through our neighborhood every once in a while. Somebody stole a letter out of our mailbox that had a credit card application and filed and used it to create a false credit card application. Long story short, we were advised by the post office to get a locking mailbox and put it on our house. We did that. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, we would come home, and every day, instead of our mail being in the locking mailbox, our stack of mail is laying out on a table on our front porch because the mailman was too lazy to put it in the slot in the locking mailbox. After about 3 weeks of that, I happened to be home one afternoon, and I caught the guy. And he's dumping a stack of mail, including things like credit card applications and actual bills and things with private information, not in our locking mailbox, but laying it on the table. And I looked at him. I opened the door. I said, hey, what are you doing? And he looked at me and I said, can't you put the mail in the mailbox? He said, well, I can't open that slot with just one hand. And I usually use the other hand to hold the mail I'm carrying from house to house. And I looked at him and I said, you can't put the mail in the mailbox because you can't set the other mail down. So you need two hands to put in the mailbox. And you're just going to dump it on the table and leave our mail sitting
here. Realize the reason we had the locking mailbox is because people were...
he looks at me and goes, yeah, what do you want me to... And I told him that story. I said, the reason we have this locking mailbox is somebody's been stealing our mail. Do you think how much easier it is to... There's somebody's going to steal our mail. It's laying here on the table. And the guy says to me, this is a U.S. government postal worker, says to me, hey, buddy, I don't know what you want me to do about it.
Wow.
How about put the mail in the mailbox? And he proceeded to drop the mail on the table and walk off.
See, and that drives me
insane. Do you want that guy deciding about your health care? Because he's a government employee and he can do what he damn well pleases, and he's going to get away with it because he's a government employee. Do you want people like that making your health care decisions?
No.
You want the nurses coming into your room when you've got a catheter stuck up you know where and you say it hurts and he says, what do you want me to do about it?
Well,
that's what you want if you want universal health care.
Then here's what people will get frustrated. They go, that's not the way it would be. But that's not ever how it starts off, right? The reason people can look down the road and go, where could it go and where has it gone, is what you're trying to prevent. The first 6 months are going to be awesome, I'm sure. And the first time you go for your health visit may be great. It's when you need something, or it's 5 years down the road. Where is the system then that you've put in place? Because the one thing
when we're all driving down to Mexico to get our treatment.
Absolutely. And I think people try to legislate morality into people, or try to take human nature out of humans. If you have a socialist, if you just take healthcare, do you truly think that the people in charge are going to take advantage of the same healthcare that they on paper they may be, but guess who's coming to their house? The doctor. Guess who's going to get a secret appointment? The person in charge. Because you know what they're going to do? They're going to take some money and pay the person extra. I would for my daughter.
Let me tell you another true story. A good friend of mine who's an attorney who I would regularly play racquetball with. And when the Affordable Care Act was under debate and it was looking like it was going to pass, and he's a very liberal, kind of one of those progressive guys, went to college in the 70s. And I said, how do you think that's going to play out in the long run if everybody has to pay into this system and everybody's forced into it, but the level of care is going to be lower for everybody? And when we're all just going to, and the government's going to be deciding who's allowed to have what treatment. And he said, I think I support it, but I'm not worried about it for me because I know the right people and I know I could get treatment on my own. So what you're telling me, buddy, and I didn't tell him this because I liked him and want to stay friends with him, but what I wanted to tell him is, so what you're telling me is your desire as a liberal progressive is to force other people to live a certain way and do certain things that you're exempting yourself from.
And you may not exempt yourself from it when it doesn't hit the fan. But when things get tight, the people with the power or the money use their power and the money to make sure their family. Mom needs surgery. She can't be on a waiting list. My daughter needs this. I'm not going to wait till next week. I'm not going to go see the person that everybody else sees. I'm going to go see Eric Buchanan, who's the best. How am I going to do that? I'm going to use my power and my money. And guess what? You don't legislate human nature out of humans. And the best thing you can do is put a system in place that allows all of us to have the same opportunities as much as possible. So I want to switch gears, though, because I want to take this down another way. And
now that we've had the political discussion.
We're going to finish it up political right here, man. So one of the things that I know about you, and we're going to transition into your education, your military background. We're going to transition into history eventually. But right now, the conversations that we have around politics, you've been following politics for a long time. In history, your whole life.
I read a lot of history books. I read a lot of political
books.
Has
politics always been this divisive? Has it seriously, in the world, or is it seriously a thing of social media construct?
I think the social media construct, the social media puts it in front of your face more often. But I think what we're actually talking about and some of the debates we're having are not exactly the same, but are similar to some of the same horrible debates that have happened since time began.
Really?
Yeah, maybe social media puts it in front of your face a little bit more, but go back and look at, well, I'm talking about social media, so I'll talk about a meme that I saw, one of those pictures that's a little cartoon that pops up on Facebook, and you know how you get the picture in your mind of all these kids sitting around on the train or at a restaurant, and everybody's looking at their phone, and oh my God, how horrible this is, why can't we interact socially? This picture was people on a train in New York from the 1930s, and every single one of them was looking at a newspaper. No one was talking to anybody else. The only difference is whether you're getting the news from yesterday's printing press, if you read the newspaper, or maybe this morning's latest news stuck into Facebook. So the way that's communicated, go back and just look at in New York City in the 1920s and 30s, in the 1890s, in the 1870s. How many daily newspapers did they have? I think it was somewhere north of 20.
Well, Chattanooga used to have two.
Chattanooga used to have three.
Three, yeah, just had three in Chattanooga.
Because the news free press was the combination of the news and the free press.
And then you had the Times.
And then you had the Times. Yeah. We had three daily papers in Chattanooga, and those are the big ones.
And some of them had morning and noon, evening.
And then they had, right. So there was a way to get the information. And people who were political junkies, you could read the paper every day. Newspapers were not neutral back in the day, and all of a sudden now they're biased.
Yellow journalism. They used to have it
William
all the
Randolph
time.
Hearst.
Yeah.
The way his newspapers worked is he figured out this is the story we're going to tell. Now let's go interview people so we can tell that story. But the bias is right out there. There are newspapers out in the Midwest that are commonly called the Blank City Democrat.
Yeah.
That's the name of the newspaper, right? So there's always been that political divide. And if you talk about how uncivil our politics has gotten.
That's what I was talking about. Here's the difference real quick, though. Facebook now is regulated. We got news coming from Clint's opinion. At least back in the day, it was biased. You kind of knew what you were getting, but it was somewhat of training involved. Facebook now, everybody's a reporter. Everybody can spew out facts that they don't have to check. They take the headline and they share it 25,000 times before we realize, oh, that headline was completely false, had nothing to do with it. And the civil part is what frustrates me. I lose friends because I disagree with the policy on the border. Are you kidding me? We can't be friends anymore because I disagree with one policy?
So there may be more of that going on than there has been when we were younger. Maybe that's true, but I think it comes and goes. I mean, there's the very famous story about before the Civil War started that a Republican Northern senator was making a speech on the floor and a Southerner didn't like what he was saying, so he picked up his cane and beat the crap out of the guy on the floor of the U.S. Senate. That hasn't happened in a while.
No.
Are we going to get back to that point?
I really and truly think that we may. I mean, maybe we should just go back to duels. 20 paces was, you know, just a turn and fire at will.
Except we do it on a video game.
That way nobody's really hurt.
That way no one's really hurt. No
Everybody's happy. Yeah. That's how we, you know what? Maybe we should do that. Like, that's how we just solve things on the floor, the laser tag guns. Bob, it's my way. I'm sorry. We're raising taxes. Dadgummit, Bob.
Meet me on the dueling grounds in the cloud where we're both going to play a video game against you.
With the visors on. God, you get to pick your meme.
Ready Dueler 1.
Ready Dueler 2. I think we just started something. That may be how we do political debates from this point forward.
Exactly.
All right, so when we first started this off, I wanted you to bring up, where did you go to college? Where did you get your education from?
I went to the Virginia Military Institute.
Okay.
if you're from Chattanooga, you'll know that VMI just recently got back into the Southern Conference and started playing UTC regularly again. They were in the Southern Conference when I went there. They have about 1,500 students now. They had about 1,300 when I went there. It is a full-time military school. It does not have any civilians during the regular school year. They do allow summer school. And it was 4 years of everything you picture when you read The Lords of Discipline. It wasn't quite that bad.
They're already throwing the old movie out. That's an old movie, too. It was a book and
it was a
movie.
Book, yeah. So the Pat Conroy book.
Yeah.
It was a great read. If you haven't read it lately, that's a book worth reading. The movie's worth seeing. But the story of what it's like to go to a Southern military school, that book, they had a lot of stuff that was true. Not
they left
all
a lot
that.
Out in the movie.
Yeah, they left a lot of stuff out in the movie, yeah.
So you went there for 4 years. Now, this is me asking dumb questions. That's why you're friends with me, because if you ever feel like you're not the smartest person in the room, go hang out with Clint, and I feel great about myself. So is it affiliated?
I was doing that with my looks, Clint. It's not how bright you are.
No, it's okay. It's all right. Everybody listen to this
knows
me. I
want to be the best looking guy in the room.
Well, we both want that one, man. We need to go to a different room. You and I need to go to different rooms. Is it affiliated with a certain branch of the military?
No, it actually has all four branches of ROTC, so okay. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. In fact, in my class, there's one guy that ended up in the Coast Guard, and he's still in.
Where did you go?
I went in the Navy. So I went in the Navy for 5 years. I flew P-3s, which are four-engine sub-hunting airplanes. They've just phased them out in the last couple of years. But for anybody out there who likes Tom Clancy, there were several times that P-3s were featured in his books. I can hunt for Red October. That was the plane that the Navy would send out to look for submarines. That was my job.
Do you still fly?
I do not still fly.
Do you miss it?
I miss it a little. The reason I don't still fly is because I was so freaking good at it when I was a naval aviator that if I tried to fly again, I would want to fly regularly at least 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a month, at least bare minimum, so that I would stay competent and current.
Right.
Otherwise, if I'm not flying that much, I would feel like I'm competent and maybe bite off more than I could chew flying, and I don't know that I have the time to put in to fly as much as I would need to.
Did you always want to be a pilot, or when you got out, did you kind of go, I don't know what I want, let me go try this or that?
I kind of always wanted to be a pilot. I knew I wanted to go in the military. I was in Navy ROTC while I was at VMI. There was a time that I thought I might go in the Marine Corps, and I was thinking about Marine versus Navy, and there's a point where you can make that decision, and the Navy came out and announced in the late 80s that if you are going to get a commission through ROTC and you can pass a flight physical, there's enough flight slots available right now that we're not as competitive as we used to be, and you pretty much were guaranteed a flight slot if you chose Navy.
Okay.
So I did, and I got through flight school. It wasn't any easier to get through flight school. It was just easier to get a shot at it because they were trying to grow the Navy at that
time. You got more opportunities. The standards are still the same. You just had more people trying it and falling out.
So I ended up going through flight school in 89 and 90 and getting my wings in September of 90. And then I was sent to fly P-3s. And I got to go fly overseas, Spain first, and then later two different tours in Iceland.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
you were traveling.
Yeah. So I've spent about 10 months of my life in Iceland, if you add it all up. And it's, the reason it wasn't a full 12 months is because there were a couple times during the 2 6-month deployments we got sent over to Germany or Spain or Italy. Yeah.
Is it exactly what everybody would think?
It's in the summertime, it's not so bad. In the wintertime, it's freaking miserable. One of my favorite stories is I was 25 years old. I'm the plane commander. I'm the pilot in charge of the plane. We flew an 8-hour mission chasing a Russian submarine north of the Arctic Circle and come flying back into Iceland, and the ceiling's about 200 feet. The runways are frozen over. It's February. And as we're about to shoot the approach, I hear the Lufthansa flight in front of us waving off and going back to Scotland. They had shot three approaches and couldn't get in. And their closest alternate and our closest alternate was Scotland, 2.5-hour flight away. And I'm the next guy shooting that approach. I'm 25 years old. It's 3 a.m. The runways are frozen over. I did it like a normal landing. We came in. We landed one attempt. We made it in. Went back to the O Club and had a beer at 3 in the morning.
A little tense, kind of.
And went to bed. And actually, the O Club wasn't open, but we had an O Club. This was pretty cool back then. Is in the BOQ, the Bachelor Officers Quarters, in our, where our rooms were. One of the rooms had been turned into a bar, so you could go get a beer at 3 in the morning.
It was kind of like college, except you guys could get shot or killed at any point in time, which we didn't have to worry about that. Have you always, we talked a little bit about this at the beginning, military history, reading. I love reading books. Over the last few years, what I have found, and I think everyone who's ever loved to read, as you get older, your time tree gets very dense, right? You know, you've got so many thousands of things going on, so you start cutting where you can. One of the first things I cut, unfortunately, was reading. And I still like to read, but listening on books now, I heard you and Bruce Dodd here at People's Home Equity talk about that. I like to listen to podcasts. I think I would like listening to books. Have you always been a history guy? Always?
I remember when my great-grandmother was still alive and she passed away in the 70s. I remember when I was 4 or 5 years old trying to explain to her why the American Revolution was my favorite war to study over the Civil War. And I was just learning how to read.
Wow.
And the books that I read when I was that age were those books about military history and the United States history.
Do you think you are a ferocious reader and a history buff because as you were younger, you were fed that stuff and it just kind of fueled it? Or do you think that's something inherently you just enjoyed and gravitated to?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was learning how to read, the stuff I wanted to go read were those war books that, especially, you know, the kind of stuff you can find today in garage sales and antique stores that I don't see for sale anymore is like the books that are aimed at teaching 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds American history. And some of them were pretty good books that explained a fair amount of what happened during World War II. You don't see those books around anymore, or the Civil War, some of those other books. And they were written sort of for young readers. You never see those anymore.
I would love to get you back on to talk about history because I know we're going, you know, I'm not going to, you actually have a job that you got to go make money at and people that looked up to you for leadership. But when we look back at history, and again, I'm not going to dive into politics. I think there's an effort now to kind of erase some history. There's an attempt to take history and let's act like it didn't happen. And I have a little bit of a different take. I think it's a great opportunity to talk about why the history is there, whether you're talking about statues or monuments or whatever. But when you look back on history, have we been teaching history, in your opinion, this is the only opinion, have we been teaching history right in schools the last 20 years? Have we changed how we teach history? Because it doesn't seem like the kids know as much about history as we did when we were younger. And I could be wrong.
Let me answer two things you brought up. I think there's been one example of something lately has been the taking down of the Confederate monuments.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not necessarily in agreement with the people who say that that's somehow erasing history, because I think there is a very valid argument that putting up a monument to somebody who fought against our government, to somebody who was perpetuating slavery, that maybe there's a legitimate argument that can be made that we should take that monument down, that we shouldn't be putting up a monument to Jefferson Davis, who led the other government that rebelled against the United States.
Right.
That taking that monument down is not the same as erasing the history of what happened. We're just not going to honor that person anymore.
Okay.
So maybe, I mean, I can make that
argument. I can understand
that. As long as we're not changing the history books, though, to not include his name.
And I think that's what I was saying.
Yeah. Right. So let me give you another example of something I learned recently. I had a friend of mine through our church who was a kid in high school, and I was talking to him about he was taking one of those tests to get advanced credit, one of the AP classes, so that he doesn't have to take, you know, freshman history or whatever when he gets to college. And all the topics on the AP American history class were about the social movements of the 19th century. Nothing about the causes of World War I and why we fought in it. Nothing about the causes of World War II and why we fought in it. Nothing really about the causes of the Civil War other than it was, you know, slavery and maybe this little bit of economics, but glossing over all that and just talking about social movements. I'm not saying those things aren't important. How women ended up getting the vote.
Yeah.
The progress of the civil rights of African Americans in the United States. Those things are important to learn, but it's also important to learn how many kids today can tell you who even fought in the War of 1812. And I run into people who don't even know what I'm talking about when I casually mention something from American history.
Well, so there's a lot you said there. I completely agree on the monument. If it's considered honoring somebody, especially a lot of times people don't understand a lot of those monuments are not relics. They've not been up since the Civil. A lot of those were put up during the civil unrest.
Let's be careful.
You know what I'm saying?
Let's be careful. I've never heard anybody discuss this when we've had this debate. And this is actually an interesting part of it. I just went on record to say that I'm not against taking down Confederate monuments.
Yeah.
But there is a lie being perpetuated about this debate, about how many of those monuments were put up later when there was the era of the civil rights era.
Not all of them. Yeah.
And one of the issues is one of the stories that's going around is how many of the monuments were put up in the 1890s and the early 1900s because it was anti-African-American, whatever. It was racist.
Right.
Horse hockey.
Love it.
Let's be really clear about something. It was against the law in the United States until the late 1890s to put up a Confederate monument. Part of our history is, for those people who actually learn a little bit of history, the reason why if you go to Chickamauga or Gettysburg or one of those battlefields, that there's this really big monument for the New York Regiment and this small little monument for the Georgia Regiment is because in 1866, they started putting up monuments for the Union Army soldiers and they could go put up their own monuments. It was illegal to put up a Confederate monument until the late 1890s. So when it finally became legal in the late 1890s, there was enough push to say, shouldn't Confederates at least be able to put up a monument to honor what their sacrifice was and where these troops were and that they died in combat or whatever? And in the 1890s, they finally passed a law allowing the Confederates to put up monuments in the first place, which is why their monuments typically are not as big as the ones that have put up right after the war when everybody, it was still fresh in their mind, they wanted to put up these monuments. It is demonstrably a false argument to say that those Confederate monuments were put up because of racism. They were put up because that's when it was finally made legal for them to honor what had happened during the war. Now, I am not defending Confederate monuments honoring people who fought against the United States. What I am trying to explain is there are a lot of people out there who try to make arguments who don't know what they're talking about.
I saw you almost say it too. Yeah. So, okay, let's take that one step further. And so this is the other part that I hear, and this may be the social media side of it, right? You can correct everybody. In the Civil War, a lot of the people that were fighting, it always boils down to that, if you ask everybody, slavery, people that wanted slavery, people who didn't want slavery. I contend that was a huge part of it. Absolutely it was. And to me, that's a right side and a wrong side. I also think that it's a lot of people, because a lot of the people that fought in that didn't own a slave. It's not like everybody owned a slave if you were in the South. There were not a huge slave owners. There was pockets of slavery, but a lot of people didn't have slaves because they didn't have money. But the flip side of it is, I think some of that was they felt invaded or they felt threatened. It's our land. It's my mom and dad are going to go fight. My brother's going to go fight. I'm going to go fight alongside my brother. I'm not really sure what we're all fighting about. Now, with that all being said, again, the slavery argument, good and bad, absolutely wrong. And I'm glad it worked out the way it worked out. But the flip side of it is, I think sometimes we boil politics down or we boil topics down to a meme or a Facebook post or something where there's not a history behind it that we lump it all in because we don't want to take the time to tear it apart. Does that make sense? Am I wrong or right?
Yeah.
There you go.
So in high school, I would submit, here's the things kids learn in high schools today. The reason we had the Civil War was to end slavery, and the reason why the South lost is because the North had more resources. Period, end of story. That's what all you need to know about the Civil War. Go on.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot more to learn about the causes of the Civil War, and slavery was a huge part of it. But if slavery was the only reason why the war was fought, then why didn't Delaware, Maryland, Missouri, and Kentucky secede from the United States? Those are four slave states. When was the last slave auction in Washington, D.C.? It was in the summer of 1865 after the war was over. Slavery wasn't ended in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, after the war was over. Wow. There was still slavery going on in the North. The war wasn't just fought over slavery. Now, it's a much bigger debate than that.
Yeah.
And people feeling like they're invaded or people who, you know, live in the areas where slavery was not common. Well, West Virginia seceded from Virginia because they weren't in favor of leaving the Union, counties in Virginia. But there were places in Tennessee and in West of Virginia where people still supported the Union, but the state still seceded. I mean,
I think sometimes we break it up that with North versus South, and there were good people in the South that didn't want slavery. There was good people. And I say all that to say this. Let's go back to talking big history picture. Hanging around you when I have been able to, there's so much behind things that people, you said it best about the monuments. It's completely okay to have the debate, and it's completely okay to tear the monuments down when it's making something a heroic thing or it's bringing glamour to something that's not deserving of it. That's good, but at least have the conversation based off knowing why it got there, off the facts. And I think sometimes in history, we forget Vietnam is another great example, you know, and a funny story about Vietnam. I share this to everybody. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about military stuff. I was traveling with Eric one time, and I just told this story to Bruce Dodd, but I think the listeners will like it. I was traveling with Eric, and I was telling him about my dad, who was 101st in Vietnam for three tours. And Eric had asked me, and you're going to have to say it again because I still don't remember it, but you asked me, had he ever been part of
the Yaw Drang Valley?
Yeah, there
did
you
he
go.
Fight there?
Yeah, and I said, I don't know. I'll text my dad. My dad at the time had a flip phone, so he hated texting. But I texted him, right, because I knew he was probably working. So I texted him, hey, Dad, were you ever part of this valley? And I get back, yes. It was hell on earth. Why? I said, I just wanted to know. He goes, who are you with? And I go, why? He goes, there's no way you could spell that correctly. I was insulted. And then I was like, I'm with Eric Buchanan. He said, tell Eric Kai. So the reason I even bring those things up is the older I've gotten, I wish that I'd become a history buff or enjoyed it as much then when I was younger as I do now, because I'm behind the eight ball on this. I'm starting late over the last 5 or 6 years, but I'm starting to learn that every bit of history that we have, there's so much more behind it that brought us to a point of the newspaper headline. And it's just, I think it makes you smarter. I think it makes you a better business owner. I think it gives you a perspective over where we're at currently. Like, for instance, when I was talking to you about the political civil debate, you immediately were like, that's the way it's been, man. You know, they just used to shoot each other or beat each other with a cane.
Yeah.
And so history to me is a great place to learn about how to keep things currently in perspective. And for those who don't think that we've grown a lot as a nation since the civil unrest, oh my gosh, go back and look at the civil unrest and what it did achieve, whether it's getting the women right to vote, whether it's segregation in the United States, whether it's lifestyle, whatever it is, the United States is consistently moving forward. It may not move as fast as some people want, but I think good people win at the end. That's my opinion. Maybe wrong. You've got a shrug on your face there. Good people do win in the end.
No, I think there's a debate going on right now about whether or not the United States Constitution should be overhauled, whether we should even be paying attention to it, whether or not get rid of the Electoral College, whether or not the Declaration of Independence. I actually had a friend post a quote from the Declaration of Independence on Facebook, and it got removed as being inappropriate under Facebook standards. A quote from the Declaration of Independence was removed from Facebook for not meeting their standards.
No.
Yes. There's a portion of the Declaration of Independence that one of the charges that Thomas Jefferson wrote, the reason why we were declaring our independence from England, was the King of England was inciting riots among the Indian tribes, and they called them, he called them in the Declaration of Independence, savages. And so you can't call Native Americans savages.
On Facebook. But you can, Declaration
of Independence. Well, but, and this guy was in an historical discussion on Facebook with other people who were nerds about the French and Indian War and the American Revolution, and it was around the 4th of July.
Right.
And he had posted this long quote from the Declaration of Independence, and Facebook took it down as against community standards.
Good or bad? Do you agree with this should be taken down or not?
Oh, hell no. It's a historic document. You should be allowed to discuss the historic document. And
that goes back to that political correctness that I think is killing
you
society.
Right. You can't ask. It's a scary thing to ask our society to remove the old offensive terms just because they weren't offensive at the time they were written. If you read Tom Sawyer, it has the N-word in it.
Yes.
We should still let people read Tom Sawyer because that was the way that word was used back then.
Yes. And I'm also a big believer, and I think what I was trying to say earlier when we were talking about statues or whatever, I think common sense, folks that have common sense, and it's almost a superpower nowadays, what they worry about is what I was...
I love that. Can I get that t-shirt, common sense is my superpower?
That is. Well, but here's why. People get worried about the extreme. Where do we go next? If I can't say this word now, what's the next word?
Fahrenheit 451.
There you go.
That's what we could be heading to.
Well, but I mean, if you look, and I think that's what
makes
people
scared. So who
wants
to burn books? Far-right conservative Christians, Nazis, and the Antifa liberals.
The extremes.
The extremes, exactly.
And I think that's why I'm moving more towards libertarian on a lot of stuff, and I think that's why people on both sides we're going to ping-pong back and forth to who wins elections, because who's ever appealing to the middle. I speak from us. I'm not scared because we the people can take it back whenever we want with a vote. But at the end of it, the reason these conversations scare us about words we can't use, right, are this monument. It's not that I'm saying monuments are good or bad. It's not saying I think that's should be offended by certain words. But you don't have a right to not be offended. And we don't have a right to not talk about history that makes us guilty. It's okay to look back at your country and go, we did evil stuff. That is bad. Let's don't ever do that again. That does not make me proud of our country that we went through it, but it makes me proud that we fought through it and we came out on the other side of it. And I'm afraid if we just start washing everything away in the past, we'll go, what is it? Those who forget history
are doomed to repeat it. So you brought up a good point, though. I think we as a country have made a lot of progress. And the reason I brought up the Constitution, the reason I brought up the Declaration of Independence is that when Thomas Jefferson wrote the phrase, all men are created equal, that we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, he may have been using the phrase all men, but at the time, it was who got to vote? It was white men who owned property.
Right.
Where are we today? People of all races and all sexes are allowed to vote as long as you are a citizen. Now, we can have a separate discussion about. I want to make sure we are clear. I'm in big favor of you don't get a right to vote unless you're a citizen. That's the whole point of being a citizen.
I think we use the word illegal immigrants and people take the word illegal out of it, and that's wrong. But anyway, yeah, continue that's a different on.
Story. But yeah. The point is that people who are still critical of the Founding Fathers and critical of that document, the Constitution, or critical of the document, the Declaration of Independence, I think are forgetting that those documents have actually succeeded in doing what they were meant to do.
Yes.
Which was to give us a roadmap to what a better free society would be like. And now we can make a much better argument than in 1776 that all men are created equal. And if you use the word men to mean mankind, that all humans who are born in the United States are created equal and have equality of opportunity, we're a lot closer to that. We may not be perfect.
Not
but
yet.
We're a heck of a lot closer to that now than we were in 1776 when those words were written. That's a reason why it's a great document to go back and read, not a reason to go talk about rejecting those principles that the Founding Fathers have gifted us with.
I agree. And it's we're equal, but not outcomes. We you know what I'm saying? One of the things that we have nowadays is that everybody thinks that equality means we all have the same outcome. And that's just not, again, whether you believe in God and the sin or not, human nature is never going to have equal outcome, ever. In the history of the world, will it ever have equal outcome? And that's right, not
we
possible.
We can have a debate over whether or not we want to ensure that there is more equality of opportunity by making sure everybody's getting the same starting line and that everybody's getting the same opportunity to climb the ladder. And if we're holding people back that they can't climb the ladder because of something inappropriate, because of their race, because of their sex, whatever it is, because of their religion, then that's wrong. But telling people that you get a head start or jump up that ladder is a little different. Because we're not promising you the same outcome.
It's the same thing, though. Right. If I'm promising you something for who you are or what you can't control, or I'm taking something away for what you can't control, and I'm not sure if the exact numbers, but I think it's the Chinese get penalized going to college because they do so much better than other people. And it can be from where they started. It can be from their family unit, whatever the reason is.
For example, in California, they have a diversity requirement, and the diversity requirement means they need to take fewer people of Asian descent.
Yeah.
So they're being now discriminatory against people of Asian descent. Instead of looking at each person's individual scores and whether you're white, black, African American, Asian, whatever.
And it seems like we go from one thing to the next where, let me tell you why the testing's not fair. Okay, well, let's fix the test. Well, now let me tell you why when you get to the test, the family unit's not fair. Okay, well, let's try to fix the family. And at some point in time, personal accountability, you got to go, when do you stop the cycle as a man or a woman? When do you say enough? I'm going to go do what other people, you know, the old quote, you know, when what's the movie? Oh, was it Edge? What's the one with the guy that played Hannibal Lecter where they killed a bear in Baldwin, Alec Baldwin, where they killed the big bear? Oh, I'm going to think of it now in just a minute. But he said, what one man can do, another man can do. What one person can do, another person can do.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. Sorry.
Oh, it's a great movie.
I may have checked that out.
Yeah, it's the, who's the guy that played Hannibal Lecter? Who's that guy? He's
Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins played like a genius. He was a genius who never had any real world experience, but he knew everything into books, photographic memory, never forgot anything. So they go on an expedition out in Alaska and the plane crashes with Alec Baldwin and a couple other guys.
I got it. Now, sounds like a good one to watch.
Oh, it's a great one to watch. And they're tracked by a bear, and it's a bear. It's a bear, you know, it's a bus That's bear.
Sounds like a good one.
Yeah, it's a good book. But he said, what one man can do, another man can do. So I think, and again, the equal opportunity is important, equal outcome. I don't think we'll ever get to that point. So you're a history buff, you flew, you get out of it. You look at the military, where we're at now. You look at what's going on now. If you could go back and do something, if you could go back into the military, go back to college, or go back and start your business, is there something you would do different? Is there something that you would say, I wish I'd have taken a different turn then, or I wish I would have made a different decision? Are you pretty happy with how it's worked out?
That's a great question. I think generally I'm very, very happy with the mistakes that I've made and the things that I've done right. Because if you don't make the mistakes, you don't learn something from them. I really enjoy fighting insurance companies for people who did the right thing and bought insurance. That's just something that makes me happy, and I really enjoy doing it. I think I'm pretty darn good at it. Getting to this point by having served in the military, by being a history buff, by reading up on the Constitution, reading up on lots of stuff that some people might consider nerdy, I think is all stuff that's got me to the right place. If I could do something over, you and I have had on other radio shows and just other conversations about business practices and what you can do to run your business better.
Yeah.
And if anything, what I would like to wish I'd done differently was start paying attention to that stuff way earlier on, or maybe it would just be impossible to know as much as I know now and go back 15 years and be able to fix some stuff. the sooner you really make it a point of learning as much as you can about ways to be more efficient, ways to run a business better, ways to manage your time, ways to lead a team better, ways to be more organized. Sometimes it takes a lifetime to learn all that stuff. It's not what they teach in business school. It's not what they teach in law school. It's maybe a little bit of what they teach in the military. It's been a lifetime of learning that stuff. I think I could have learned that stuff maybe a little faster by spending more time reading the self-help books and going to seminars and talking to business consultants and finding a mentor earlier and sooner. That's what I kind of wish I'd done differently.
I always hear you preach systems and processes. And I think the reason you preach that so much now is because you lacked them when you first got into the business, right? Or you tried and failed, or
it took a long time to get them in place. I think I always instinctively knew that you needed good systems and procedures in a law firm or any business. It goes back to, you know, being a pilot in the Navy, and what happens if something goes wrong? You have a checklist for that emergency. You have to memorize the first couple steps so you can go and take care of that stuff and then call for the checklist. And knowing what to do in an emergency with just having it so well memorized, you just rattle it off. That's a procedure. That's something you learn in the Navy. Any pilot learns how to handle an emergency by going through a set of procedures. Well, things in procedures are amended when they come to the type of procedures you follow when you have an emergency in an airplane. They're amended over time as somebody learns about maybe that isn't the right procedure to follow because of something mechanical that happens in the airplane that we didn't think about when we wrote the procedure in the first place, and that plane crashes even though they did the procedures properly. Well, what's the lesson learned? Write a better procedure and keep improving your procedure. Well, in our everyday business world, if we crash, it's not going to be killing people in an airplane, but it might be a bad day for a client. It might be a bad day for a customer. It might be a bad day for an employee. Well, let's not all stand around and point fingers at each other and get mad. Let's go back and look at what were the procedures that got us here and how can we fix those procedures going forward. And I think that's something I preach constantly to my team. I am not going to assume that if something goes wrong, it's because one person on our team made a mistake or screwed up or wasn't thinking. I'm looking at myself and the management of my firm to go back and say, how did this happen in terms of our procedures? What can we do to write an even better procedure and do training on that procedure to make sure the staff knows to follow that procedure so that this mistake will not happen again? And I think I end up with happier clients and happier staff because at the end of the day, we know that our cases are going to be handled well. There's still a certain amount of work that has to be done by the individual attorneys to make the arguments on cases and to really go fight the case. But knowing that all the underlying work has been done properly because everybody follows procedures is a huge part of having a successful law firm.
Or and any knowing, yeah,
and it can work. And I'd say, right, for any business.
Absolutely. I mean, right. Looking back on why I closed Connect, I did a radio show on it. And one of the things I said was that, in my opinion, the things that killed my business and I think can kill any business is one, ego, asking everybody what you should be doing and only listening to things that confirm you're good at stuff and not paying attention to the stuff you do wrong. And the second is starting putting systems and processes and procedures in place and stopping it because you get busy. So you have a half system, a half procedure. Everybody knows kind of what to do, but not really. And it leads to ambiguity. And then it's fine when things are good. And when things go bad and you don't have the system like you were talking about in place, you don't know how to handle your cash flow. Well, if you have good systems in place, you know what happens with the money when it comes in the door. It's like the Plinko chip. It just goes down the board. And if you don't have that in place, you can get lost.
So one of the biggest, most important lessons I would say is as a takeaway for how to deal with all that stuff, you have got to, as a business owner or a manager, mark off time that you're going to work on your business, that right. You're going to work on the systems, that you're going to work on the procedures. You just gave a whole litany of examples of things that can go wrong if you start working on your procedures and don't finish them or don't follow them when the time comes or don't hold yourself accountable. A lot of what can solve those problems is if you dedicate Monday mornings, Thursday afternoons, 3 hours a week scattered across the week, where that's your day to work on your procedures with you making sure they're done right, or your team, and have a team meeting. This is why we do it this way. This is why we're supposed to do it this way. This is why it matters to do it this way. And then your team member says, but what happens in this situation? You go, oh, crap, I didn't think about that. Well, let's add this part to the procedure to cover that. But if you don't spend the time, you're not going to make
you have become better, reactive.
You're not going to have better procedures. And the common answer from a lot of people, but I don't have time to do that. I'm busy out selling houses or running the restaurant or trying to go to court for my clients or go to see patients or whatever it is. Then you're not going to get any better. And you're just always going to be reactive. Marking off time and making it a commitment that you will spend the time working on your business, working on your procedures, working on your long-term goals, working on things that are all about how to run that business better, have dedicated management time, have dedicated procedure time, and stick to it.
I say this all the time when I do seminars. If things get busy and you've got a calendar full of things and you see on their calendar you've scheduled 12 o'clock to talk about your marketing or spend time on yourself, when things get busy and everything hits the fan, who's the first person you cancel a meeting with? It's usually yourself, because I can make it up, because I'm always with me. And the problem with it is, with business owners or decision makers, very rarely, unless we're held accountable, do we make up. You can't make up time. That's just a lost hour. And that's where your problems come from, especially if you have somebody to help hold you accountable. That's the other thing I said. I had people that were trying to hold me accountable, but I was digging in to be right. So when you dig in and that ego takes over and you're trying to be right, I'm a good business owner. And a good business owner knows when you're not good, just like a good pilot, just like a good rugby player. Knowing what you're not good at allows you the opportunity to delegate it as a business owner or work on it. Before you bolt out of here, so I know you're a huge book reader. I know you're a history buff. You know, I've been fighting a sword fight with a switchblade over here, so it's been rough. I'm going to try to read something before you come back. But give me two or three books people should go read. And give me one book that you look back on as a history book or something that could help people that would just be fascinating, a fascinating story. First, a fascinating story, and one that would help with a business.
Fascinating story right now. Anybody out there who has not read Boys in the Boat?
Okay.
I think that's a great read. There's a documentary about it, I think maybe on Netflix, but the documentary is not as good as the book, and it's way, way better than just watching the documentary. If you are a fan of audiobooks, it's even better because it includes sports that sound great on the radio. Mm-hmm. And when this part of the book is read as an audible book or a book on tape or whatever you call it these days, the play-by-play is just fantastic. So here's the basic premise. During the Depression, Washington State, the University of Washington had a rowing team that was not the best rowing team even in the Pacific. And the Pacific had not the best rowing teams in the United States. And rowing was one of the top three or four sports in the United States at the time. I think in large part because it was something that sounded really good on the radio. You could listen to, a crew race. You could listen to these boats race on the radio, and the play-by-play could be pretty darn exciting.
Right.
Kind of like baseball can be pretty good on the radio, but football's harder to listen to, and it's really hard to follow soccer or golf on the radio. Just some sports don't match up. Rowing's one that really worked well on the radio. Well, the premise of this book, without giving away the whole story, is that during the Depression, some of these kids who managed to get into the University of Washington had been homeless or working on farms or working in the lumberjack mills. We're talking about the blue collar of blue collar kids who'd gotten into the University of Washington. And if they got on a sports team, they got free meals.
Wow.
And these kids who joined the rowing team eventually represented the United States at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. And how that happened is one hell of a story.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's one hell of a story.
Give me a book that would help a business owner that you've read. It could be a history or not. Give me a book that if a business owner were out there right now and they're pretty successful, but they need to get over the hump or they need to keep learning, just somebody that gives a crap about being better.
So one of the self-help books I think that's really, really good, it's a story. It's just a self-help book. It's Five Dysfunctions of a Team.
I never heard of it.
Five Dysfunctions of a Team talks about the different things that can break down a good team. And then if you go online and do some research about the book, there's a way of looking at it as the five positive attributes of a team. And you kind of build it in a pyramid. And I'm not going to give away the whole book because it's copyrighted and people should go read it. But it starts with a foundation of trust. If your team members don't trust each other, that we're all in the same boat and we're trying to get the same thing accomplished, we're going to take care of our clients, we're going to take care of our customers. If not everybody's on board with that and trust each other to assume that if somebody's being critical or asking questions or commenting on somebody else on the team, that it's being done for the purpose of doing better as a team, then you're going to break down the team. If your instinct is not to trust your coworkers and not to trust your employees because they've got their own agendas and they're out to get you, that's not a great team.
You start assigning motive. Yeah, that's bad in any relationship. Yeah.
And then it walks through trust, and they talk about fear of conflict, where if your team's not willing to bring stuff out in the open, the people working for you, Clint, were not afraid to go to you and say, Clint, we're about to mess this up. This client's about to be really mad. But they didn't come to you and tell you that because they were afraid you were going to be mad at them. Then you're not working well as a team. They've got to have permission to come talk to you and not be afraid that maybe we'll have a little debate. Well, who screwed that up? Why didn't somebody tell me this sooner? But that's just healthy.
I never liked that because then they always said, but you told us to. Oh, crap. You mean I'm the one?
Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And it reads actually pretty well because it's told like as a story of a woman in a new company putting her team together.
Well, those are two books I'll try to listen to one of them on Audible because I listen to stuff I don't have time to read. I'm so busy now. I say that with a smile. How'd you get into rugby?
When I got out of the Navy, I started law school. I got out of the Navy, like literally I flew home from Iceland on a Thursday, and by Monday I was starting law school.
Wow.
So I got off of I flew my last mission as a plane commander in Sicily off the coast of Yugoslavia, probably on a Wednesday, flew back to Iceland on Thursday and flew home Thursday night to the United States, and had to get a Ryder truck to where my law school was with my wife and I by that Monday. So I walked into law school just literally having taken off my uniform. I was still getting paid my Navy terminal leave for about 20 days at the beginning of law school. So when I got to law school, I was just coming off the Navy. All of a sudden, I'm in this very unstructured school environment. Other people are stressed out as heck about law school. And I'm like, holy cow, this is like the best vacation I've had. 4 years of military school, 5 years of the Navy, and now law school's like, this is super awesome. And so they had club day. They do that in law school, too. They have club day about 2 weeks into law school. I get out there, and there's the Federalist Society, and there's the PILSA, which is the Public Interest Law Student Association for people who like to do like social work kind of law. And one of the tables that was set up was the rugby team. And one of the guys who was an upperclassman who had been a Marine, I found out, was the captain of the rugby team. And we got to talking. I had signed me up. I want to find out how to play this rugby game. We played spring and fall for all 3 years of law school.
Right.
And by the time I graduated from law school, I'd at least learned the basics of the rules and didn't look like a total idiot on the rugby field. And then I came to Chattanooga, and about a year later, I found the Chattanooga rugby team and started playing. So that would have been in 98. And I've made a lot of good friends.
They're good
through
people.
Rugby. A lot of good friends over the years.
And it's a great sport. I think it's the best team sport ever. And people who don't understand the rules, how much you have to be there for your fellow teammate in order to be successful.
I look back on it and wish that I'd done a better job of staying in shape when I played rugby, so I could have done a better job supporting the guys on my team, and really, really happy for some of the success we've had over the years of those great games. And then just the social aspect of getting to be friends with the rugby players. I can't tell you how many people that I played rugby with that I run into town, and it's like the instant the bond's there again. Hey, there's rugby. My friend Matt, and I have, you know, and I'm still great friends with him 20 years later.
Yeah.
There's my friend Clint, who we still can give each other a hard time, and even if I'm better looking, I don't point it out very often.
Better looking and smart, and make more money. There you go. His wife's a lucky lady. Well, and you know what's funny about rugby? I said this to Tim Kelly, who owns the CFC, and Sean McDaniel, who's the manager. I would love to see what happened with the soccer that happened with rugby, because it is a sport that does want, if you got people there, to me, it's like watching hockey. If you try to watch it on TV, you get lost. But if you go to a rugby game and the excitement of a rugby game and someone sitting there that can kind of answer some questions, go to one. Just go to one game and it's on. After that, you'll be like, I want to go watch more of that. That's awesome. Maybe down the road. We just got to find a field big enough.
Google the Chattanooga rugby team. They got a website. They'll tell you when the games are around Chattanooga.
Then we might run into each other down there.
Yeah.
It'd be good because it's down to Montague. The old Montague Park.
Yeah, is where they practice, and they play there for home games.
And they got good fields. We didn't have that luxury.
Yeah.
We practiced on parking lots. And my first practice ever was in the parking garage at UTC in front of McKenzie Arena. It was raining. It was five people showed up on a Tuesday night.
That was your first practice?
I got tackled on the concrete, and I said, this is awesome. And the coach goes, yeah, you're going to be okay. I went home all scarred up. It was fun. Man, I appreciate you coming in.
Absolutely. This is great. Thanks for
having
me.
Here's what I want to do down the road, though. Let's come up with a topic. I want to read up. I want to be able to ask better questions, and I want to come up with a top on history. I want to have a podcast on history. When you have some more time, we don't have to hurry it up, and I want to really talk to you about some of the stuff that I know you love. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's great.
I think that would be a fun one. That would be a good one. No insurance. May talk a little rugby because I like doing it, but a history one. I think that would be good. Eric Buchanan, tell everybody how to get a hold of you, Eric.
Our phone number is 423-634-2506. Our office is at 414 Macaulay Avenue, which is across the street from First Centenary United Methodist Church, near Memorial Auditorium and near UTC. We have a national practice helping people fight insurance companies if they've been denied disability insurance, long-term disability, health insurance, life insurance. We represent clients I haven't looked to see if it's every 50 state, but it's a lot of them. And we work with local attorneys in other states where we need to. We just took in another client from Hawaii. We regularly go to New York for these cases. I was just in Pittsburgh last week. We do a lot of work all over the country helping people fight to get the benefits they deserve.
Also, Tay, if you're a business owner or someone in HR department and you're looking to get some critical eyeballs on stuff before you buy insurance, Eric is also available for that kind of stuff because he can get in front of some issues and help you make the right decision.
I'll say it this way. When we end up fighting over employee benefits, when insurance comes through work, I don't want the employer to be the bad guy. I don't want to have them be the one that gets sued or gets in trouble. I want them to understand what they're doing. It's the insurance company that wrongfully denies a claim that is the one who needs to be standing up in court and answering for it and paying the money they are supposed to be paying, not the employer that did the right thing. But employers can make mistakes.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying call you.
Yeah.
Call you first and let them let you put your eyes on it. Episode is brought to you by JB Millworks, my friend Jeremy Price and Ringo. They do windows, doors, they do stair parts, they've got trim work, they got doorknobs, they got everything to make your house, if you're building it or remodeling it, make your house more beautiful. Call Jeremy Price at JB Millworks. You can Google him or call him 706-965-6940. JB Millworks, 706-965-6940. Eric, thanks again.
Glad to be here. All thanks for having me, Clint.
All right, and thank you for listening. Thanks for listening to During the Break. If you have any questions or suggestions, shoot me an email at clint@connectchattanooga.com. That's clint@connectchattanooga.com. Or you can private message me on our Facebook page. As we get started, it would be extremely helpful if you could rate and review the podcast on iTunes. That will help us get more listeners. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast, share it with your friends, and look for the next episode every Friday at 11 a.m.